So, as part of Roundtable One, I'd like to make a contribution to the topic Decolonizing Knowledge and Participatory Methodologies, Framing the Debate. So, I propose then in my short piece now to talk about whose ideas count, participatory methodologies, and the professionalization of development knowledge. Now, tackling the question of whose ideas count is central to efforts to decolonize knowledge. So, participatory methodologies then are, at least in theory, one way to address concerns that some ideas and the people with whom they are associated might matter more than others. So, widening participation to include more diverse people and views makes intuitive sense. The hope is that this will lead, at least partially, to counting the knowledge and ideas of more people. So, surely this is a good thing. So, in my short piece today, I'd like to unpack a participatory research process to consider not just which ideas count, but who gets to express them and how they need to express those ideas in order for them to be counted. So, what is the problem we are proposing to research? How do we decide what the problem is that requires researching in the first place? Now, in most ways, any approach to decoloniality kind of comes unstuck at this first hurdle, because our higher education systems and the associated methodologies that we tend to privilege neither require us nor support us even to consider whether we're even the right people to be asking the questions in the first place, let alone whether we are then the right people to be undertaking the research, should we manage to determine that a problem even exists that needs solving or understanding further. Now, by defining the problem before we've started, which, along with defining impacts, which sounds very counterintuitive, because how can I know what's going to happen until I've done the work? But anyway, another conversation for another day. Which we're required to do in order to even have the project funded in the first place. We're meant to talk both about the problem and what we might anticipate are the possible solutions, even before we get the funding. Then any participatory process is entering a problem definition that is already framed and therefore pigeonholed in ways that are difficult to unsee and undo, no matter how much participation or learning or iterative reflection we've built into the study design itself. So here, I think we would be wise to remember the words of Linda Touhiwai-Smith in her book Decolonizing Methodologies, Research in Indigenous Peoples, where she says, and I quote, "Many researchers, academics, and project workers may see the benefits of their particular research projects as serving a greater good for mankind, or serving a specific emancipatory goal for an oppressed community. But belief in the ideal that benefiting mankind is indeed a primary outcome of scientific research is as much a reflection of ideology as it is of academic training. It becomes so taken for granted that many researchers simply assume that they as individuals embody this ideal and are natural representatives of it when they work with other communities." End quote. This may indeed be our intent, and is no doubt what motivates most, if not all of us, engaging with this conference and its key themes. But we mustn't presume that our engagement in a research project is entirely unproblematic or even welcome, even if we choose to take a participatory approach. Okay, so maybe we can overcome this. So, which ideas count and who gets to express them? Well, let's assume that we do manage to curate a participatory process at the inception stage of a research process. This is not entirely an unheard-of process. There are increasingly funds being made available for pre-bid co-creation processes, and ODA, so that's Overseas Development Assistance guidance, that says we need, as Northern-based researchers, to ensure that research agendas are led by the needs and identified priorities of Global South partners. Well, that sounds all right. But how does this look in practice? Well, let's look first at the question of ideas. So, what ideas are we talking about in these spaces? Now, what these types of investments, these sorts of investments in co-creation processes, laudable as they are, cannot erase, is that European empire has shaped power relations that in turn create enduring perceptions of, for instance, progress or the primacy of the West as civilized or advanced against a backward or poor developing world. It is a worldview that is deeply divisive along raced and gendered lines, underpinned as it is by a patriarchal white supremacy. And make no mistake, whilst there are a diversity of views around how the world should look, The SDGs, driving as they do so much of current development practice, are a good encapsulation of how we envision a life that does not question the basic assumptions about how we should live, ideas proliferated through the expansion of the colonial enterprise. And also the fact that the colonizers continue to shape and reshape that. So what life looks like now is obviously not what it looked like 100 years ago. But what a good life looks like is still dominated by a very narrow set of overarching key ideas. There are plenty of critiques of the dominance of certain types of development thinking, the hegemony and subsequent invisibilization of diverse people who simply became underdeveloped with Truman's inaugural speech in 1949, alongside the erasure of over 400 years of violent colonial expropriation, extraction, slavery, and domination. The result is that we live with what I would call dominant ways of knowing, enabled by processes of professionalization and embodied in notions of terms like expertise. So professionalization, for our purposes here, means only those suitably qualified may participate, creating variable forms of discursive inclusion and exclusion. Now, one response to this hegemony is tied inextricably to participatory methodologies, insofar as we operate in a way that tries, as much as possible, to incorporate the views and voices of the global South, and I put that in inverted commas, including through co-creation processes undertaken by so many of us in good faith to try to shift those power relations, to make space for pluriversal approaches to problem solving. But when we do this, what do we presume is happening with respect to our shared goals of decolonizing knowledge? One reason to put in place participatory methodologies is to privilege something we've come to call Indigenous knowledge. This idea both that there are untapped knowledges and that these knowledges in many instances emanate from Indigenous groups displaced by historical settler colonialisms. At a theoretical level, drawing on the work of scholars including Olwig, Laurie and Escobar, that in reality, development rationalities are so entrenched that some critics have argued that for many individuals, communities and groups, it would be almost impossible to envisage futures that are not bound up in some form of development imaginary. So in short, there is no untouched, untapped knowledge out there waiting to be discovered. Since knowledge is continuously changing, evolving, new knowledges are created as new information is absorbed. And Indigenous knowledge is itself a catch-all term that actually subsumes, so it actually has a tendency, in fact, to homogenize a diversity of people and knowledges, but almost all of which exists in opposition to and has thus, almost by definition, interacted with, even if it's by rejecting it, colonial knowledges. And this is key. Despite our best efforts, it is important not to underestimate the universalization of the Western frameworks that we operate in. Despite our best efforts, especially in the purpose, function, and constitution of higher education globally. I don't think it's impossible to work outside these frameworks, but I think it's a bigger challenge than we're willing to admit. Okay, so we've talked about ideas. I think there are challenges there. They're not insurmountable, but I think they're quite big. But let's move on to consider people. So who gets to participate? Now, I have found in my research the tendency for dominant frameworks to be proliferated and ultimately reproduced by transnational elites in a range of contexts. This raises questions about whether it's enough if a research idea comes, quote unquote, from the global South, which is presumably at least partly what more inclusive participation is meant to facilitate. Now, privileging the views of and engagement with Global South colleagues is undoubtedly important given the global imbalance of power in knowledge systems. But talking about diversity is not good enough. The fact is, the Global South is not one homogenous entity. So, for instance, it has experts too. It too is a profoundly unequal place and in many instances manifesting inequalities along gender, race, sexuality or class lines that are directly and indirectly themselves related to colonial legacies. And this is no less true when we are in field sites amongst the so-called grassroots. So from the point of view of participatory methodologies, we need to ensure that we are moving beyond thinking it's enough to simply change the race, gender or class status of the messenger and instead ensure we are also raising more fundamental questions about the message. Now, the other aspect of this tick box exercise to diversity is the homogenizing tendencies of development labels or categories. So Global South stakeholders become monolithic, undifferentiated categories, including, quote unquote, the field or, quote unquote, the grassroots. And other terms we use in this space include feminist, activist, practitioner, academic, or my favourite, the local. I mean, where is the local? This tendency to essentialise or homogenise has been a key concern for many development feminists. And in my own work, I have suggested that, in fact, the term Global South has become a signifier of an imagined geography of exclusion that does not account for inequalities or elite practices in Global South contexts and can, in fact, invisibilise regional inequality almost entirely. So we could think about how we diversify people and ideas. They're important, but there's a danger that it's not enough and we need to be mindful of the pitfalls. So how do ideas then need to be expressed in order for them to be counted at all? Now, in my experience, we are very good at talking about the exclusion brought about by ideas and the people who have those ideas. What we don't talk about nearly enough is how we know the ideas that dominate our practice. Can participatory methodologies address that? Now, I would argue that how we know, so how we document and then disseminate our ideas, is as important as the ideas contained within. As I have argued in my work, quote, legitimacy is achieved not just by alignment with dominant and or depoliticized technocratic discourses, but concretized through particularized ways of knowing, embodied in the written formats in which dominant knowledges are recorded, validated, and proliferated. So let me be more specific about what I mean by this. So one key concern here is the language of our practice. This is meant in the literal sense, insofar as we function primarily in English. With what has been termed the post-colonial turn in translation studies, there are attempts to ensure that we take more nuanced approaches to meaning creation in translation. But regardless of these types of efforts, the language of formulation is most often a professionalized, academic, jargonized English. So the knowledge itself doesn't count as academic expertise or knowledge unless it's written up in English, using development jargon, and put in a written format that can be turned into a PDF and put on a website, and preferably for those profit-making publishers out there, behind a paywall. This English language write-up is then disseminated orally in an elite space such as a conference, webinar, or workshop, much like the one that this recording is going to enter into, and in which we are going to be discussing these ideas, and no, the irony is not lost on me. But the result of this, I have found in my own work, is the creation of two separate language worlds. Participation, in sort of inverted commas, happens in local languages at the grassroots as part of what we call in our practice the field study, where participatory methodologies are increasingly not only an accepted but desirable norm. This also tends to be, go hand in hand with what we would think of as data extraction. So it's very one-sided. But for ideas to be validated in elite spaces in ways that may influence policy or practice, they need to be translated, pigeonholed, or theorized with respect to dominant frameworks that fit the expectations of our discipline, and then disseminated both in print and in fora such as the one in which this recording is entering. Now, we might have a more participatory process that is less extractive, that is more convivial, that's more inclusive, that has more talking. But I would argue that process of validation still means that we have to convert that knowledge and validate it in ways that are acceptable in the elite spaces that information gets taken up. So where does that leave us? Well, we need a continuous reflection, I would argue, about the range of voices, views, and ideas we seek out, as well as how we gather and then choose to codify and represent them. We need to consider the implications of our methodological choices, the assumptions that underpin these choices, and the power relations that legitimize them, manifesting as academic or professional approaches to research. We need to actively problematize the rules of research. But the idea that there is some pure, alternative, authentic worldview untouched by notions of development or modernity or intersectional concerns such as gender, race, class, or sexuality is not, I would argue, a reflection of reality. So when, for instance, we seek out local voices, these are not more authentic. These do not exist separately from the mainstream or represent entirely separate life worlds. Rather, how and through what mechanisms or codes we know the world is shaped by interconnected life worlds, outwardly interacting, creating continuities and discontinuities alongside new forms of knowledge. For me, actually, it's much more important and interesting and relevant to talk about power, which I feel we don't talk about enough. What kind of life do people want? Whose ideas about sustainable development count? Who gets to decide what progress or empowerment looks like? We have come up with global goals, such as the Sustainable Development Goals, and whilst they provide a laudable blueprint for global social development and justice, we need to be able to acknowledge that there is likely to be a diversity of views of what constitutes a good life and how we might go about tackling things like extreme poverty, climate change, or promote women's rights. But with some voices more powerful than others, this is a dialogue that in our everyday research practice, even if we have tools like participatory methodologies, it's a dialogue that's still very difficult to have. And power is not simply about the North having it all and the South having none, although I'm not trying to take away from the very real power imbalances that still fall on North-South lines. But it's also not about men having all the power and women having none. We need to reflect more carefully on whose ideas count and how these ideas become validated and taken up in global level discourses such as the SDGs. What is clear, and again the irony of this recording being very one-sided, is not lost on me. What is clear is that we're doing lots of talking, but not much listening. People, wherever they are and whatever the circumstances of their lives, are not empty vessels or blank pages waiting to be filled up or written upon. We have to start listening and working out what people actually want or need to know, rather than just assuming that we know best. And we need to think then about how participatory methodologies might help us to do that better. So the question then remains, and what I'd like to think about in our roundtable, is how can we work in progressive ways within this model of research in higher education? Or is the only way forward to fundamentally challenge or indeed change that model? Thank you.